can tell I am. And so this helps me blow off the steam, you know what I'm saying? And I can talk here as long as I can hold this down, and I don't have to, you know, I can't really be too concerned about how many people are listening. And since not often do people come in and make a response of any kind, I can just blithely go along and, oh well. Suffice it to say that I just enjoy doing this. KK4JBQ.
Well, that's good, Larry. I enjoy doing it as well. And we need people that enjoy doing that. And you might even, with those comments, get people to think about it and join in. We used to have roundtable sessions that went to 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning after Annette. And people would check in. We'd just keep the net going. And we'd have well over 100. It wouldn't be anything outstanding to have 120 check-ins. But it was at 1 o'clock in the morning when it was finally over with. And those were back in my working days. I don't know how. I think I had Saturday. No, I had Tuesday night there for a while. And then I had Saturday nights for a long time. I guess that made it easier. But I used to go on 4 hours of sleep all the time. And that wasn't a big deal when I was working. I was like, you know, I'd wake up and I couldn't wait to get to work. I really enjoyed my job. I wake up that early now, too. I think it's once that gets set in, that's that way for life. I don't know. Sometimes I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I watch the clock until 4:45, and then I just get up and go put on a pot of coffee, get the dogs up, take them to go outside and go to the bathroom, and then let them run around while I'm getting coffee because we got two new puppies that just, they're like little angels. Having puppies is really, really uplifting. And we got two of them, and it's really, and the cat just kind of looks at them as they go by like, you dogs are crazy. And they'll stop and they'll bark at her, and she'll look at them, she'll turn her head, and they'll turn their head, and they're getting used to each other now. But that's a really good time in the morning. That's when I'm most productive. That does make it harder to stay up later when you get older. You combine the three. When I was younger, I could do all three, no problem. But the older I get, the harder it is to do both really, really early in the morning and really, really late at night. But, you know, when you talk like that, you might get people to say, hey, you know what, I can do that too. So it's good to bring that up, Larry. Let me check one more time to see if we've got anybody else that wants to check in, and I'll be right back to you. Any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net, call W4DJW.
Charles, the guy's got a question for you, Dave. Talking about... up there on Caesar's head. How in the world do you not keep, what do you do to keep that from going crazy on you up there?
Well, the more I learn about it, the more I understand what makes it happen. Like today, I went into it today. And it was because I was laying, and I talked about I had to see my heart doctor. Like that was it just now, just went off. I see my heart doctor just once a year, and he tells me the last two times I've seen him, he said, go away, I don't want to see you for another year, which is a good thing. You want him, that's what you want him to say. So he put me in the one percenters for AFib. If you're like the 50 percenters for AFib, it's much more serious. The thing that, and I was talking to him about the hurricane, because during the hurricane, I went into it four times, Andy, and the nurse that was seeing me before the doctor got there, she was asking me about it, and I was telling her about it, and she said it probably, because, you know, I had a tree that's like 3 feet in diameter at the bottom and 2.5 feet at the top, and it fell across my neighbor's driveway, and that just bugged me till it was gone. It took us almost 3 days to get it gone, and I was out there with him cutting that tree most all day, every day, until we got that thing completely gone. And she said it probably wasn't the work that you're doing that caused you to go into AFib that time. It's the stress that causes you to go into it. And you know what? She's right. And I forgot to think about that, and then I repeated that to the doctor, and he said, absolutely, it's not the work. It's not the physical work you're doing. It's that you knew that you had to have that tree out of his driveway so he could get in and out of his house. And that's what drove you into it. I used to think it was because, like I was cutting down trees, I would go into it. When I was under the house today replacing the dryer vent, I got out from under the house and started eating and went into it. I used to be able to get on the elliptical and get myself out, but I can't do that anymore. It doesn't work. But RF up there, RF doesn't have any. The only thing where RF Andy comes into play is there is if you get really bad and you can't come out. Like I can usually get out of it within 4 to 8 hours, or overnight. Right. If I can't get out of it in 4 to 8 hours, the next morning I'll be out of it. If you can't do that, if you get so bad you can't do that, then they take you to the hospital and they do a RF burn on the inside chamber of the upper part of your heart to kill the nerve that's causing it to do that. And that's kind of drastic. But then if they get that right and it works, then you never have it again. It's gone totally, permanently solved. If they get it right. They don't always get it right. But the RF up there, there's 1,000,000 watts going on that antenna that's right up above us. We are in the deep null of that antenna when we're standing on the ground, so it's not like we're standing. It's not like we're standing in 1,000,000 watts. We're standing in the deep null of 1,000,000 watts. So it doesn't really hurt us that bad when we're doing. I don't think that's a trigger for AFib. What makes AFib come on is stress, high levels of stress. I used to think it was working too hard. Oh, and one other thing. Dehydration. If you're dehydrated and you're under a whole lot of stress, that's the thing that triggers it for me, Andy. I know that was long and drawn out, but just wanted to share what all I've learned across the last 2 years on it. KI4LTI W4DJW and the Blue Ridge 2 Meter Net.
Tell us, yeah, well, I'm glad to know when you are up there, that don't affect you. I don't know if you ever knew Jack Norris or not, W4DJW. He went up there with us one time. He had a pacemaker. After about 30 minutes' time, he had to leave up there. If he hadn't, it would have killed him. All that high RF up there and his pacemaker, he couldn't stay up there any longer than that.
And that's the same way it was for my dad as well. My dad, being a ham radio operator, he had a pacemaker, and he asked his doctor about it. And his doctor said not to do it for very long. He said brief periods of RF, especially if you're doing a kilowatt or a kilowatt and a half or something like that, if you're a ham radio operator and you're within 30 or 40 feet of it, that's hard on a pacemaker. But that's totally different than AFib. That's not they both have to do with the heart. The pacemaker is the mechanism that gets your heart back in sync. The AFib is a little bit different than that, right? It's the upper and the lower chamber fighting with each other. So your heart is pumping, but they pump the lower and the upper chamber pump at the same time, and you can't have that, right? And the valve isn't like blocking it; they just pump in the same direction at the same time. Your blood doesn't do anything; it just sits there. Like when I came upstairs, I have to find a place to sit down just by climbing stairs when I'm in it. I climb the stairs and then I sit down, or otherwise it will sit me down. So to be safe, I sit down. But totally different things, Andy. But you're absolutely right. If you got a pacemaker, you gotta stay away from high RF.
You know, I figured your detector in your phone or whatever, I would tear it all to pieces, not make it accurate. They was letting you know when you was in that situation as high as that RF is up there. But it's good to hear. I just was up there when that happened to Jack Norris, and he had to get out from up there real quick, and he couldn't wait around. Back to you, KI4.
And yeah, Andy, I knew Jack Norris. We went riding around a few times together in the car. Had a good time talking to Jack. Was a character. I went over to his house with Gary a few times. Looked at his equipment. He gave me the grand tour Oh, man, did he have some ham radio equipment. And his tower, you could stand underneath of it, and you could look straight up, and that's the 100-foot tower. And, Andy, that tower was as straight as an arrow. There was not – I've looked at other people's towers that are that high, and you look – if you lay your head down on the tower and you look straight up one of the legs, they're not always straight. Man, he had that – he knew how to put up towers. He knew it inside and out. That was a loss for the amateur radio community when he passed away. But, yeah, and he was a card, too, to talk to. He was fun to talk to. He had some really good stories about the past and – his life story about getting into radio. I don't know if he's ever told you all about that stuff, but who he talked to and how they got into getting radio stations up and how much power they were transmitting is amazing. Some of his AM stations weren't transmitting more than 25 watts and very popular AM radio stations. It's just the altitude that got it working for him. So, yeah, Andy, I enjoyed being around Jack Norris. I wasn't around him as much as I would have liked to have been, but the times that I was around him, he was a card. He was fun to be around. Larry, we left you out there. KK4JVQ, W4DJW in the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
For JVQ, well, that's quite all right because, you know, the other half of, what do they call it, jaw-jacking? I think that's how it's I think that might even be a CB phrase, to tell you the truth. The other half of that is just sitting there and listening. And anyhow, I got a question I need to ask Andy, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Go for it. W4DJW in the Blue Ridge 2-meter net.
Okay, Andy, you still with us?
Yeah, I've been here. The whole time I go ahead and do the pre-net to make sure I don't forget it. Because on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I'm generally listening around on the HF frequencies. I'm here, I heard him talking about that, and I remembered what happened to Jack up there. You got any kind of issue like that that's where it's RF sensitive and they might drive it crazy, that's not a place you want to be. Go ahead. Larry,
KI4LZI. Well, the thing I needed to speak to you of is the, I think I agreed to send you some audio files of amateur radio history as received here from a podcast called This Week in Amateur Radio. So I was able to isolate a couple of files I sent them along to you, and I just wanted to see, to check with you, see if you received the files and if they played for you okay.
Received them? I certainly did receive them. I'm kind of like him with Rayu Boulevard. I'm taking it a piece at a time as time goes by. Digesting it, so to speak. That's just like what I said about that Rayu Boulevard. I've known about something like about it that comes up, like Jerry told me the other night about, and I go back and re-look at it and read it again, and yeah, I got them.
Well, the reason I ask, I wanted to kind of gauge whether you would like more of that sort of thing. As I explained, the gentleman who did that for so many years, I've been listening to This Week in Amateur Radio for about, maybe 8 years now. And the original fellow passed away. Actually, it was a tower accident, as I understand it, that got him. And the new fellow that picked it up, which is, he was on the files that I sent you, they were similar in how well they disseminated the information. But Dave, if you're still listening to this, Andy is, as you well know, a historian. He's a history buff. anything amateur radio. So this particular segment of this podcast is all about the history of early radio, of the early organization of amateur radio, of early early organization, such as it was interesting to me to learn, at least, for example, that the FCC wasn't in business when amateur radio began, and so it was a free-for-all, just to put it mildly, it was a free-for-all. You could make up your own call signs, you could run any kind of wattage you wanted to run, any sort of equipment, everything was an experiment, you know, and slowly, over time, things got more organized, and it was probably tough for those old guys to be organized by a federal government institution. Yeah, so anyway, all of that's very interesting, and that's what that particular segment is about. It only, you know, occupies maybe at most 15 minutes of a two-hour podcast. So isolating it, pulling it out, sending it to Andy. This is only possible now because Andy has he can receive the file now. And so I sent him a couple of files. KK4, JBQ. Back to you, Dave.
No, that is interesting. My dad used to talk about that kind of stuff too. He talked about when the war came along, they shut down all amateur radio operators. Nobody could transmit. They wouldn't let you do it, and they were shut down for quite a while the war was going on. I don't remember which war that was, but I used to like to listen to the information back then when my dad would tell it. But I was a lot younger back then, too. Any storytelling that comes out of your parents or your grandparents or anything like that was always intriguing to me. But let me check another time, see if we've got any other stations that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net called W4DJW. Okay, that looks like we've got everybody there, Larry. Well, what else? What else you got for us this evening? KK4JBQ, W4DJW.
As I said, the files that I sent to Andy were about were by the fellow who took over from the unfortunate fellow who'd been with it for years, and I used the most recent issue, you might say, of This Week in Amateur Radio, and picked it out, and it was on exactly what you spoke of there, how amateur radio changed during World War II, anyway. During World War I, it was a different thing. I mean, people were not amateur. Radio was around, but it was in its infancy in World War I. In World War II, people were very active, and there were a lot of people who called themselves hams, and, you know, but they had to wrap up everything. They had to put it in a box. Those boxes were sealed in front of people who could swear that they were in a box and it was all bound up. And it was, I think it was 19 months, as I recall, 19 months that, so, you know, if you are completely addicted by what we enjoy in this hobby, what did you do? What do you think they did? They went and signed up. Yes, indeed. They signed up to be a radio operator. And they had all of the, you know, all the drive and a lot of the talent to be very useful within the Signal Corps, I think they called it early on. And, that's just very interesting. Just very interesting. So, anyhow, I guess I'll be carving out more of those and sending them along to Andy. I'll pop one up toward you and Dave and see if perhaps You might be interested in them too. KK4JBQ.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Do you send that via like a email link and you just download it through the internet, or how do you do that?
It gets to be kind of a large file to be sending over email, but if you can, well, what I did was that I got this just voice, you know, nothing real critical, and so I got it down to an MP3 at a rate that wasn't too big, and the two files is about as much as I can send over email. But what you're speaking of, I think I have the ability to send you a link to a Dropbox, and you just pull it out of their server. In other words, that's really the best way to do it. And Andy, if you're still listening, I'll talk to you about how that operates, and it's better. And the files can be larger. Dave makes a good point there. KK4JVQ.
Tell us again to keep the files small because I'm using a Windows 7 professional computer. One, which is way behind, if we all know, but this other computer guy over here not far from me and far from Randall told me that I could use that, being that it's a Windows 7 Professional, which was meant for work applications. They still send emails out. And so far since I've had it, he's been right. But even at that, the memory in it, you know, we all know because it's old, it's got limited memory. So I have to take that into account on whatever I take in. You know, I don't have the biggest ball of memory in the world, and it's going to be limited. So I'll let you know when to send some more over to me. Go ahead and send some to Dave and let him learn about it. And as far as the two wars goes, the way I read and understood on all this, during the number one world war, no transmitting or receiving either one, but in those days it's primarily CW, you know, spark gap. Number two, you could listen, but you couldn't transmit. And you wouldn't, and they would burn you too if they caught you doing it, no doubt, for good reason if you done it. You weren't supposed to say, like if it was a Japanese out in an internment camp in California, and you listened and heard something that you shouldn't, then you somehow spread it to them, then from them it got back to Japan, they'd burn your camera back. They got here with what little still left on analog, not a lot, but if you take and hear something on the air, for whatever it is, then you let somebody else know somehow a crime or something that's not supposed to happen happens in it. They can charge you with that. But as everything's leaving analog now, that's getting to be a less of a issue now. But that's how, from what I have read about this, how during the two wars, one and two was. KI4LZI.
Brandy, it is true. And for a long time I struggled with how strict those regulations were. Of course, World War II was before my time. I came along about 10 years later. And then I watched this, oh goodness, can't remember the name of the TV show now, but it was all about this couple who resided here in the United States. They were spies. They lived as, they weren't married, but they lived together in a home in a community that welcomed them as husband and wife. They were spies. And the only way that they could catch spies during World War II, which, you know, the surveillance equipment was not like what we have now. And the airwaves, of course, weren't as crowded as they are now because, you know, think about what's going through the air all around us every minute of the day. So, anyway, it was pretty much because all hands had to cease operation of any of that kind of equipment. Well, that made it easier to find the spies. And this couple were caught. They were tried for treason, and they were hanged. I mean, that's how serious that was. How and I that straightened me out. I understood then why it was so imperative to close down amateur radio during the World War. KK4 JPQ.
I'm gonna go ahead and shut the net down. He and I could talk here the rest of the night if we're not careful on some of this. So you go ahead and do whatever you do with the net and not let us not keep you up half the night. You take it, KI4LZ.
All right, Andy, I'm going to take you up on that because the dogs need to go out for their final, going out to relieve themselves for the final time before they're down for the night. So I do need to take them out. So I appreciate that. Larry, you good with that?
Absolutely. And thanks for calling the net for us tonight, bringing us together. And it's been a right enjoyable evening. Thank you for that.
Well, I enjoy it very much myself, and I like it when you hang around for the net. Makes for a whole lot better net. Do we have any other stations all the way through the alphabet that would like to check into the Blue Ridge 2-meter net? Call W4DJW. Okay, be sure and stop back by tomorrow night where KO4HKX Patrick will be calling Blue Ridge 2-meter net. Same time, same frequency. Don't miss it. I'm sure you'll enjoy it, and I'm sure he'd appreciate you stopping by there. Please stand by for my net report. This is W4DJW now securing the Blue Ridge 2-meter net with our thanks for checking in. We'll now return the repeater back to normal amateur use. 73s and good night. And appreciate it, Andy. Appreciate it, Larry, KK4JBQ and KF4LZI. W4DJW clear.
LZI, KK4JBQ.
LZI. Yeah, it was back prior to about September, October of 1912, that part about it being a free-for-all, no allocations, that was really the case at that prior to then. It was, and the Navy Department wasn't too happy about it. And as a result, they really didn't want amateur radio reactivated after World War I because of that, but that's when the licensing procedure started, went through the legislature in Washington sometime about September of October. But prior to that, whatever call sign you want, wherever you want to operate, just fine. During that time, sometimes when they come up, we're about the 200 meters and below situation.
It was a different thing. It was a different thing, and part of this particular series of history of amateur radio that I enjoyed so much was, and this was over several months of time. This thing. That podcast is issued, I think, on a Saturday each week. And so it might have been 7 or 8 different episodes discussing the history of call signs, how they came into use, and how they changed over time, how they didn't anticipate the many thousands of call signs that would be needed. How the rest of the world, as it caught on to radio, did a similar thing with their own population. and how they're, you know, right now, the union worldwide, the union that is specifically responsible for this kind of organization in amateur radio, there are three different areas. We are in, I think we're in region, I want to say region one. I might be wrong. But anyway, it's all coordinated over the whole planet now. And so that kind of coordination allows for all nations to do what they do, issue the call signs that they issue. It became, there's another podcast that I listen to. I think the guy's name is Anno Pinchot. Yes, Anno Pinchot. I think I've got that close anyway. He's an Australian, so he's got quite an accent, but it's easily understood. Some Australians, that accent's so deep that it's kind of hard to catch on to what they're saying. But Anno, and his first name is spelled O-N-N-O, Anno, O-N-N-O. He has a call sign that is a 2 and 4. You know, here in the United States, it's the maximum that we would have is a 2 and 3. I've got one of those call signs. KK, then a number, and then 3 letters. Australia, for a time, that has changed recently, but for a time they issued call signs that were 2 and 4. And he says, I remember him saying once in one of his podcasts that it really irritated other operators around the world when he would give his call sign and they did not expect 4 letters in the suffix. And they would call him on it. They'd say, that's wrong. That's wrong. It's either 1, 2, or 3, but not 4. Yeah, well, anyway. So I think recently Australia has changed their mind on that, and they limit new call signs to 3. But those who want to keep a 3-letter suffix, they can do that. So Anno can keep his 4-letter suffix. How about that? KK4JBQ.
Well, see, I haven't looked into it in such great detail about that, but I picked up at one of the ham fests years ago. I got a chart right over there on that about that lists about some of the foreign call signs. It's listed what the locations are at. You know, as of here in, say, the past 8-10 years, I don't remember which ham fest I got that chart at, but I got it over there on the other side of the wall over there with that. It, I do. So, it can, of course, this is on HS, and I don't know if they have that on internet or not, but I pick up what they call wave scan. That's on WRMI 5950 on Wednesday. Let's see, that time is, our time is 7:30 p.m. And on WWCR, this very night, it is, but it comes on at 11, I'm trying to remember, 11 to 12, both those stations carry that wave scan. Now, last week's thing they talked about, various radio stations, certain parts back off up there toward Newfoundland. Don't think the timeout's on it, but Newfoundland up there, various radio stations up there from when they was on AM to eventually go on the FM. They was talking about broadcast. It was broadcast, but it was about broadcasting Christian radio broadcast. They talked about up there in Newfoundland and over there in UK prior to that about that. I don't know if there's a way you can get that without getting it on HF or not, but I found that very interesting there about that, too. Talking about such as this around the world and about different broadcast type situations in history on it as well.
Well, I suppose I've only been in amateur radio for, I think, about 12 years now. And so what happened before, I just don't have any clue. But it, like you, it all interests me. I'm, you know, curious about how everything got started, how all of the difficulties were finally overcome, as we learned, you know, and as people experimented. And you remember, I can't, you'll probably remember his call sign, David Stansel. Do you remember David?
Yeah, W4KA. The best I remember, you was the one that told me he'd become a silent G. I know I ain't heard him in ages on 70 centimeter or 2 meter, but as I said before, what I use here barely is just good enough to receive on HF. Just barely. So I certainly can't do a whole lot of transmitting, but yeah, I remember he passed away before Jack did.
He's a silent key now. Dave, while I was vice president of the club and arranging all of the programs that were offered to members during club meetings, Dave came twice, that I recall, twice to for and brought us a presentation. And one of the things that he did that I appreciated and remember very well is that when he started his presentation to the club, he would say, he would be talking about, well, one of the, this is all jumbled up. One of the things that Dave brought along, kind of a show and tell, you know, Dave was very fond of paper. He got awards and certificates, and he, his shack was, I think, quite a large room. And he would bring, he would mount these things in frames and put them on the wall. He would get these certificates, some of them not much more than an acknowledgement of contact, you know, sort of like a QSL card, you know. But some countries and some operators in some countries would be very, they would just make these most beautiful acknowledgments of having made the contact, you know. And Dave was proud to have those things, so he'd bring several boxes full of those things. But he'd always start his presentation with a little contest. He would ask the whole room of hams, he would ask us all a question. And it always had to do with a singular thing. He would give a prefix, and you know, the prefix on a call sign all over the world, the prefix is unique to the countries. So even technician class operators study what letters of the alphabet are appropriate for a U.S. call sign. Now, yours is KI, mine is KK, and for a time that there was an order, and They were very strict about when they issued those call signs, and the number was always your area four here. But now you can have a 9 call and live in this area of the country. It wasn't always that way. If you lived here, you must have a 4 call sign because you were in the 4 call area. You know, that makes sense, I suppose, but it made a lot of trouble for a lot of people. I guess most folks are happy that it's no longer that way. But they would throw out a prefix, and you won if you were the first one to identify what country that prefix was from. And there was always some smarty in the room, way back in the back. I never turned around to see who it was, but somebody would call out, well, that's Uruguay, or something, you know, like that. And some folks do have a memory like that. They are aware that all countries have, I don't know if it's just 2 letters, maybe it's 3 for a prefix. I'm not sure how they get all countries into that. But anyway, that's some part of the organization that over time has really changed. You know, your prefix, your call area, and your suffix. It's changed in the United States. And then the license class, of course, would be indicated by that. You had an N that was your first letter in your prefix. But that's all over with because there's no novice licenses issued anymore. Anyhow, all that is because we weren't there, you know. We weren't there when this was a thing. It's interesting to learn about it. KK4, JPQ.
Tells the guy what he was doing there at the meeting. If you had that chart, I got, you know, I'd have to go over and look at that chart if he asked that question to me. Because I don't have anything really with anything that allow me to transmit. Barely have anything to receive on. But what you was talking about describes that chart. I go on the other side of the room about all foreign countries. Call signs and prefixes. And I think I told you this probably a long time ago, but probably about 6 or 8 years before you got your license, K.A. had been vice president down there of the club at one time.
For sure, I didn't know he was an officer of the club. But in any event, he was a fine fella. I just remember him. He was just a nice guy, you know. He came that night with boxes full of what he called his wallpaper, and he'd discuss it. He liked it because, you know, people, hams in other countries, went to a great expense sometimes to have very nice certificates drawn up. And he was just terribly proud of those things. And it was just an awful bit of news to hear how they've he just passed away suddenly. And you know, when someone passes, somebody that you knew, somebody you shook hands with, somebody you've had conversation with, it, you know, it just, it makes my head spin, you know, because they're just not here anymore. And you've heard their last utterance. The last time you heard them speak was the last time you'll ever hear them speak. Yeah, so, anyway. It's one of the nicest parts for me, at least one of the nicest parts of this hobby is the people that I meet. You can, if you've got the resources, you can buy any radio. You don't have to make your radio anymore. You can buy any radio, as long as you're flush with money. You can put up any antenna. As long as you have the property to put it on and there's nobody to tell you what to do, you can put up an antenna of any kind. But that's not what the hobby's all about. It's really about the people that you meet, the other hams that you meet, and how enjoyable it is to hear their experiences. What it was for them to buy their first radio and to, you know, learn how to use it and to put up their first antenna, perhaps, and how they learned to use it, you know. And that's what this hobby is about. And for Dave, for Dave Stansel, it was the wallpaper. He called it wallpaper. And he was so proud of that. Anyhow, Andy, I'm going to have to hang it up. It's about 9 minutes till 11 as I read the clock. And, you know, you've got some medication to take. And I got to get some Z's. Tomorrow's going to be another day. I hope it's a good day. I hope it's a good day for you, too. And I hope to talk with you again real soon. This is KK4JBQ. I'll be clear. Good to talk with you, Andy. 7-3.
Tells the guy that about the novice. The novice class started sometime after World War II. The novice class did. Sometime in the late 40s or the early 50s, the novice class. I remember at one time Ray saying, and of course he had his call sign from start to finish. The only difference was when he first got his novice, he was KN4SUG. Then when he upgraded later, because I heard him say this with his own mouth, they dropped the N out and it became K4SUG. But the KN4 was his original call sign as it was set up with the novices at that time. It was. And as far as that brown book goes, it's kind of, way it described, of course, the cough rate was 22, 23, somewhere in that range, of how they had things set up. It was in the teens. They talk about that on that one particular page about the call districts around, and it wasn't necessarily called per se at that time. Novice, technician, general, advanced, extra. They kind of, it's hard for me to, without actually looking at it right now, but there were certain specialized type of licenses that universities could have, and certain more. It wasn't set up, as you say, the way it is now. They didn't even have it set up in such way as that. And also by certain emission classes. That way that book talked back in the teens, it was set up different from when any and everybody went everywhere due to want no allocations to the way it is now. So as you say, over the decades, there's been all kinds of ways that it's been set up one way to another. You know, Federal Radio Commission, which has ultimately become Federal Communications Commission. And before that, heck, I sent off with that chart over there, and I can't remember now. My head ain't working too good. Board of Governments that had it at the time that was, you might say, was what the Federal Radio Commission was at that time. But after 1912, allocations started coming in, and I'm sure the call signs started at that time right after that as well, official call signs, no matter what they was. KK4JBQ, KI4LZI.